Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
I am Velocity Child, and every Friday at the stroke of midnight, ride the broomstick with fallen woman, stirring up the cauldron at Radio Free Brooklyn.
There's something I want to tell you, something I want you not to forget. When you think of your life as an open field or an empty field, or something has occurred in your life, a great transition of some sort, even great turmoil that makes you feel as though this field, once filled and alive, has been burnt to the very ground, please remember that new seed is faithful. It comes on the wind, whether you want it to or not. And it roots most deeply in the places that are the most empty. Don't forget that. In the stories I have for you now, they're put together like matryoshka dolls. In our family, we have a tradition of fitting one story inside the next. And among my people, both the Mojores and the Mexicanos, we have long traditions of telling stories while we work at our daily labors. The young people often ask questions about the living of life, especially matters pertaining to the heart and the soul. And most often, these questions are answered by telling a story or a series of tales. We consider story like our living relative. And so it seems to us completely sensible that as one friend invites another friend to join in the conversation, so too a certain story evokes a second story, and then a third, and then a fourth, and a fifth, until often the answer to a single question of life has become several stories long in its answer. Our practices are not sophisticated, they're rustic. So you can see why, before I tell you this singular story about that which can never die, I must first tell you the story of my uncle. He was an old peasant farmer, no one fancy. He survived the horrors of World War II in Hungary. He brought the essence of this story about that which can never die. He lived it. He brought it through burning forests, through memories of unutterable events, of days and nights in slave labor camps. He brought the seed of this story with him just as surely as he brought himself here to America. Through all of this, and much more, he held the spirit of this story in a refuge near his heart, somehow managing to hold it away and to hold it safely from the wars that were crackling inside of him. But even before I tell you his story, I have to tell you the story he told me about this man, the old farmer he knew in the old country who attempted to defend a young and precious grove of trees from being destroyed by a marauding army. However, in order to tell you the story of this man, I must first tell you a story about how stories were created to begin with. For without the creation of stories, there would be no stories to tell at all. And no story about stories, no story about my uncle, no story about this man, and no story about that which can never die. Though in my family, the old ones practiced a tradition called make story. This being a time when, over a meal rich in the aromas of onions and warm bread and spicy rice sausage, the elders encouraged the young to weave tales and poems and other pieces, and the old ones laughed with each other as they ate, and they said to us, "We're going to test you to see if you are gaining any knowledge worth having. Come now, come give us a story from scratch. Let us see you flex your story muscles." And so this story about stories was one of the first I wove as a young child. I had heard one of my aunts, Katya, tell stories from the Bible by heart over and over again. And that is how I came to tell this story. The creation of stories. How did stories come into being? Stories came into the world because God was lonely. Yes, God was lonely, for you see, the void at the beginning of time was very dark. And the void was dark because it was so tightly packed with stories that not even one story stood out from the others. Stories were therefore without form, and the face of God moved over the deep, searching and searching for a story. And God's loneliness was very great. Finally, a great idea rose up, and God whispered, "Let there be light." And there was light so great that God was able to reach into the void and separate the dark stories from the stories of light. And as a result, clear morning stories came to life, and fine evening tales as well, and God saw that it was good. Now God felt encouraged, and next separated the heavenly stories from the earthly stories, and these from the stories about water. Then God took great joy in creating the small and the tall trees, and the brilliantly colored seeds and plants, so that there could be stories about trees and seeds and plants, too. God laughed with pleasure, and from God's laughter fell the stars and the sky also into their places. And God set into the sky the golden light, the sun, to make the day, and the moon the silver light to rule the night. And in all, God created these so that there would be stories about the stars and the moon, and stories about the sun, and stories about all the mysteries of night. And God was so pleased with these that God turned to creating birds and sea monsters and every living creature that moves, and every fish and all the plants under the sea, and every winged creature and all the cattle and creeping things and all the beasts of the earth, according to their kind. And from all these came stories about God's winged messengers, and stories about ghosts and monsters, and the tales about whales and fishes, and other stories about life before life knew itself, about all that had life now, and all that would come to life one day. Yet even with all these wondrous creatures and all these magnificent stories, even with all the pleasure of creating, God was still lonely. God paced back and forth and thought and paced, and finally it came to our great creator. Let us make human beings in our image, after our likeness. Let them care for and be cared for in return by all the creatures of the seas, all those of the air, and all those of the earth. And so God created human beings from the dust of the ground and breathed into their nostrils the breath of life. And human beings became living souls, male and female, God created them. And as these were created, suddenly all the stories that go along with being completely human also sprang to life. Millions and millions and millions of stories. And God blessed all of these and placed them in a garden called Eden. Now God strode through the heavens, wreathed in smiles, for at last, you see, God was lonely no more. It was not stories that had been missing from creation, but rather, and most especially, the soulful human beings. who could tell them. Now, surely among the most soulful humans ever created, especially those mad for stories and hard work and the living of life, were the dancing fools and the old crows and the grumpy sages and the almost saints who made up the old people in my family. This included my uncle, who, whenever I told the story I had made up, the creation of stories, he would shout afterwards, he said, "Listen, my friends, to what this child has said. Do we not believe in a God who loves stories? But for us, then, God would be lonely. We must not let God down. So a story now, another story." And we went on with our work and our stories, and sometimes all day and hard into the night. We would go on with our stories. That one who called for another story, that one was my uncle, whom I called Sovar. For whenever he had a few pennies, he bought himself a big, loosely rolled cigar, and he took great pleasure in trying to smoke it, and smoke it, and smoke it, before its light went out for the thousandth time. Now, uncle was a relative of my foster family, an old farmer who one evening at dusk in Hungary, long ago, during World War II, had been dragged from his small farmhouse and had somehow managed, as he said, through divine forces no one can understand, to stay alive after being taken off to be worked and starved to death in a slave labor camp far away at the Russian border. Back when I was growing up, every time someone said, as news commentators on the radio and strangers on the road sometimes did, "Nazi Germany did this, the Deutschlanders did that," uncle gave the same quiet counsel. "You are mistaken," he would say. "The Nazis and their helpers were not from Germany. Cowards have no country of their own. Those demons were from hell." After a long time, the war in Europe had raged itself out, and my foster father, with help from the Red Cross and the underground workers, searched the refugee camps, finally finding our old uncle and later several other elderly relatives. My foster father helped all be released from the camps in which they were held. But to find a port to sail from, the refugees had to crisscross Europe by foot and by cart and by lorry, until with many inspections of papers and much fearful, gut-wrenching waiting, they could struggle up a gangplank into the belly of a great ship bound for America. There were no phones on either side of the great ocean, no way to tell whom was where and when. Everyone's fate was held in the hands of strangers, farmers, and families along the roads, and underground holy men, and brave nuns and nurses in tiny outposts, all of whom in our family we still refer to as the Blessed. For 3 weeks in the dark, uncle came across the ocean. Thence, in a sweltering summer, he journeyed half across the northern border of the United States by teeming train. The air was steaming in the heat by day and suffocating by night. And finally, notice of uncle's arrival was sent to us in the form of a telegram that arrived at night, and the telegram had no message typed upon it. The financially poor refugee organizations of that time arranged to send a blank telegram the day before the refugee was to arrive at the appointed place. So when we received this telegram with no writing upon it, we knew that uncle's train would arrive sometime the next day at what had been designated Refugee Depot, the great rail station in Chicago, 100 miles to the west of our tiny rural village. I was 5 years old the day we boarded the railway to go gather uncle up. We rode for 3 hours to the west. The train stopped at every orchard lift and every wooden crate platform along the way. We took along enough family members to be counted as a small, sovereign nation. We carried enough head cheese, bread, bags, boxes, bottles of water, homemade beer and wine and warm seltzer to feed and water ourselves and 50 other families should the opportunity arise. Squeezed together like canned plums in a pint-sized glass jar, we rode the interminably hot train all the way to Chicago. Yet we were filled with longing and hope and excitement to find our war-torn family member and to bring him home at long last. The wait for Uncle's train was very long. In the great iron-raftered grotto that they call a railway station, we waited through the afternoon, then into the evening, and finally far into the night, all in a heat that withered flowers and clothing and humans. The great mass of humanity thronging there was further confused by the fact that the loudspeakers announcing track numbers for train arrival so echoed in such great peals that no one could make out what was being said. The platform shook and shuddered with each train's arrival and the sound of iron brakes screaming down on iron wheels, the enormous loud clankings and great hissings and the smells of oil in the engine stacks and from the kerosenes in the railmen's swinging lanterns, all of these were profound to me. The trains were made of blackened steel and iron. I had never seen creatures so large. They were put together with what seemed like hundreds of perfectly matched wheels, both large and small, and thousands of rivets all around. And a beautiful gold writing was outlined with red on every rail car all the way down the line. And the engine stood three times higher than the tallest man. And the heat from just one of the trains felt like the blast of 25 furnaces. People sagged against the railway station pillars, and without an ounce of exertion, they, as my foster father put it, they schwet like elephants. From my point of view as a child, everything was all elbows and stomachs and rear ends and all shoulders and cranings of necks and men's stained shirts and women in cocked hats with feathers wobbling and high heels that looked like deer hooves. And there were women in babushkas with unshaven legs and arms and people with shrunken bellies and men in black suits made gray by the smoke and ash of the trains. And there were many old people so bent over that their size was more equal to mine, and I could meet directly the eyes of many of the old ones, and they smiled at me with somewhat alarming, toothless, but ever so kindly smiles. And crowds gathered around one door or another all the way down the long rows of rail cars, and I had never in my life seen so many grown-ups crying and dancing jigs and laughing and backslapping and cackling and calling out all at once. People thronged and tears were everywhere overlaid with these specific smells of garlic, whiskey, and perspiration. And the fog of the humid night and the steam from the great engines hovered in a huge nimbus around the entire scene. Suddenly, the ever-moving jumble of herringbones and solids and plaids and polka dots parted, and far down the platform, in a lonely space, all of his own, stood a bewildered old man, dressed in ragged peasant garb. He was haloed behind by the great railway lights in wire cages. From the look on my father's face, I knew this was the soul we were seeking, because for a moment, father's face lost all expression entirely. And then he leaped. Yes, he leaped. I am certain that my tall father leaped across the dozens of baggage cars and shouldered his way upstream through waves of humanity in order to finally throw his arms around this one gaunt and towering man. My father directed poor uncle across the platform, holding him around the shoulders and guiding him by the elbow, bringing him through the crowd. This is your uncle, my father cried, as though he had just won every bounty worth winning in the entire universe. Uncle was a huge man up close, like a giant from fairy tales come to life. He wore a wilted white shirt with no collars or cuffs and long baggy pantalons, so wide they seemed like a full skirt that hung all the way to the ground. His raw red forearms were knotted with muscles, and I had to bend my head way back in order to see his face. He had mustachios from cheek to cheek, and I could smell every foreignness on him, from the sheep's wool of his misshapen knitted shoes, his bochkors, to something like lake water in his hair. And Uncle set down his little sack of goods and his cardboard suitcase, and he slowly took off his hat and knelt before me right there, on the concrete walkway. And many shoes and boots hurried all around us. I saw the sweat-soaked silver hairs of his sideburns and the fluorescent silver bristles on his chin and cheeks. And Uncle reached out and held my head with one giant hand and put his other arm around my body. Then I will never forget his words as he hugged me close to him. He whispered, "A living child." Although shy of strangers, I embraced him wholeheartedly in return, for though I knew no words to describe it, then I understood the look in his eyes. It was a look I had already seen once before in my young life, having seen the eyes of horses who had survived a swift and terrible stable fire. This newly found giant uncle came home with us, and I learned that he was a man of much solitude. And I also discovered that even when he took his cigar out of his mouth, one side of his lip was higher than the other, and his mouth would not close evenly. He'd say to me, "This is what comes from smoking cigars as a little boy." And then he would laugh, and he'd say, "Don't you smoke cigars, and then your pretty little mouth will not look like mine when you grow up." Oh, I love this uncle. Even though his front teeth were gray when he smiled, and he had dark and scary molars in the back of his mouth, and his unusually broad brow was marked by astonishing eyebrows that were like wire brushes shaped into wings that hung out over his eyes like visors, and his hands were enormous. They could hold 5 pheasant necks all at once, and best of all were his light eyes in direct sunlight. They seemed the color of a molten gold. Uncle had only a second grade education, and he lived in the new country as he had lived in the old country, as a man who could mend a harness but could not repair anything that had parts driven by electricity, a man who could drive a herd of oxen but not a car, one who had never owned a radio but who could tell stories until dawn, and one who could spin and weave cloth but could not figure out how to walk onto an escalator. Once a man in a suit came to our fence to try to sell us insurance, and Uncle Tsovar did not understand why he should buy insurance if he was betting against his own good health. The man called my uncle an ignorant oaf. But this salesman did not know my uncle. did not know that Uncle's life had been burnt to the ground, and that he still remained kindly toward children, and that he was still tender with animals, and that he still believed the land was a living being, one with its own hopes and needs and dreams. Like the other refugees in our family, Uncle suffered from his memories. And he tried hard not to speak directly of his experiences in the war. But people have to speak of what has hurt them. Otherwise, the war beast jumps out in nightmares and sudden weepings and fits of anger. And when Uncle did speak of the past, his words were somehow far worse to hear when they were brief. He would say, "It was very bad." This was followed by a long silence. More often he spoke in tales, and even in the third person, such as, "I once knew this man who said that the worst part of the slave camps was that loved ones were separated from one another. The mothers and the fathers went insane, completely insane over the whereabouts of their sons and daughters, and the children. And here, Uncle would simply stop, rise up out of his chair, and walk outside. In rain, in snow, in daylight or night, he fled to the out-of-doors, and he would not return for a long time. I loved him, and I feared for him. And during these times, the adults suddenly and stone-facedly turned back to deliberately peeling their potatoes and knitting the socks and bringing in the wood and sweeping the floor, all in utter silence. A silence, you see, that came from trying to protect themselves from their own loosely tethered ghosts. But I ran out after Uncle, and I always found him, walking down the road, or having stepped off the road into the fields, walking through the woods, or repairing little ropes and wires in the smokehouse. And it was by running after Uncle that I came to learn about his odd friend and alter ego, this man, the one that Uncle once knew in the old country. Uncle referred to this man so often over the years that, out of respect for the suffering that caused this man to come to life, I came to call this faraway spirit self this man in capital letters, and sometimes that man also in capital letters, just like any personage worthy of a proper name. Once Uncle told me, this man I used to know, he was haunted by the last images of old women in the village as the wagon trucks hauled the men and boys away. They, the old women, with hardly any teeth left, howling literally to the heavens, lying down on the ground, with the snow flying into their eyes and mouths, banging on the muddy ground, old women on their hands and knees, beating the ground with their fists in grief. This man has so many memories." My uncle would continue the story. "When the foreign army first came, and before they took everyone away, they said to this man, 'If you just give us food, we will spare your grove of trees. Just tell us which stand of trees is yours, and we will spare it.' Trees. Oh, my God, the trees. We all grew stands of trees for love, for shade, for windbreaks sometimes. To see us through the winter, we sold some little part near the edge of a seedling crop when they were large enough. This man had grown these trees, you see, grown them from their childhoods onward. They were his pride and joy. So this man tried to protect the trees. Like all the rest of the farmers, he had gone to school of the fields, not the school of the teacher with eyeglasses. No one understood this war that swooped down like a giant hawk and carried off entire villages into the nest of hell. No one knew how to escape. In desperation, this man answered the soldiers, Which trees are mine, you ask me? All the trees you see, for as far as you can see, all these are my trees. And he pointed to not only his trees, but to those stands of all of his neighbors, and to the ancient forest that stretched for miles beyond all the way to the horizon. And for this answer, they threw him to the ground, kicking him in the mouth over and over again for having a lying tongue. And they broke this man's jaw, and they left him. In a rage, they set fire to the immense deadwood at the centers of the biggest fir trees, and the dry branches exploded in flames from the bottoms to the tops of the trees, and in so doing, burnt the stands of trees to the ground in a matter of moments. For a long time, our small house was filled with many people who had just come from war and back from the dead. They carried hundreds of horrific images and losses that cannot be described in words alone, though my relatives gradually brought out their beautiful and haunting songs and their one-of-a-kind stories. The pain of war, entrenched in mind and spirit, went on and on and on. War does not end when the war is over. At first they could not cease speaking with great emotion about all that had happened to them, and later they made the most stalwart efforts never to speak again, ever, about what had happened to them. And for a long time, the war beast had its way with them in many ways, many times over. What does it mean to live in a war and with memories and the war itself inside? It means one lives in two worlds, one looking for hope, the other feeling hopeless, one looking for meaning, the other convinced that the only meaning in life is that there is no meaning in life. In each of our people who had suffered so greatly, there were two struggling persons, one living the life of the new world and the other running, constantly running. Running from the memories of hell that rose up and gave chase, ghosts animated by themselves, roused by the click of a door frame or a cat in heat, screeching suddenly in the night, or the innocent dog at the screen door scratching to come in, or a sudden gust of wind causing a curtain to sweep ajar off a table in a shot to the floor. Mundane matters cause terror, tears or revulsion, the smell of a certain kind of gun oil, the first snow and fresh blood of deer gutted for food, a certain kind of bone ache from field work, an old story about a bridal veil, a sound of cattle hooves on a metal culvert, a sudden train whistle, and the sound of the long trestle rumbling. There were wars in Uncle that made him remember, as he said, too much. There were wars between the death of hope and the hope for death, the hope for life and a life of hope. Sometimes the only ceasefire that held for any length of time had to be negotiated by a treaty forged with much schnapps and much vodka. But there were also times of great peace. Uncle knew the land like he knew the lines on his face, like he knew the veins on the backs of his hands, the backyard, the side yard, and then out into the near field, and then the middle fields, and then the far fields. And when we walked through these fields, our boots became heavier and heavier, clotted with black mud, 1 pound, then 2 pounds, then 3 pounds on each foot, and the tops of our thigh muscles pulled hard, and it took more and more tension to unstick one's last step in order to take the next. But this we loved, this small struggle that did no one harm. This was our modest proof that we were managing to live anew. We walked, listening for the health of the plants and the trees and the crops about us. You can tell the health of the plants by how they rustle. Was that bush filled with as many butterflies as needed? Let us count them. Were the trees filled with as many warbling birds as needed? Both birds and butterflies were critical to the carrying of pollen among the fruit trees. So there would be abundant cherry crops, so there would be a goodly amount of pears and plums and peaches to be put up for winter. As we walked, Uncle would muse. I have heard people ask, where is the Garden of Eden? Anywhere we stand on this earth, we are standing right in the Garden of Eden. This entire earth, underneath its railroad tracks and its highways, under its worn coat, under its rubble, under all these is God's garden, still as fresh as the day it was created. But we would not gouge the earth back to life, nor try to bring Eden about in great shovelfuls. No. No matter how large the garden, 1 cubit by 1, or huge fields you cannot see the end to, if you are directly planting, you do so by patting and patting the earth, taking little handfuls of it up. Be gentle. Be economical. Do not take immense shovelfuls to get the job done faster. Like the pouring of milk into flour, you do not dump it all in all at once. No. Gently you pour a little, and stir a little, pour a little, and stir a little. And this is also how to treat the land thoughtfully, with presence of mind. Oh, this is how I learned that whatever happens to the earth can also happen to us. How we treat the earth is how we may hope to treat others and ourselves. That whatever happens to this field in some way also happens to us. And all these matters we watched over so that we could see the condition of everything and how the crops would be and what was moving across the fields and in us. We were content to live in these kinds of days. And Uncle's wandering spirit, chased out of him by so much war, began to hover near him again. And little by little, Uncle began to grow back into one person instead of two. And this being all well and growing green again everywhere until there came a certain day. It began well enough in the morning, but by early evening, all hell had broken loose. The state road commissioners sent officials down to announce to all in our rural village that the state would annex land belonging to the people. The state would annex land and build a toll road through the quiet woodlands where we lived. They would annex entire forests and fields, these essentials that were the healing grounds of the war-torn people that we lived with, the land on which the people grew, all of us, the summer and winter food, the hide-and-seek places where we played, the piney bedsteads of tramp rail riders and the shelters of those who just called a tarp and a stick pole home. For ever so many, our lands were rest and also repair of our souls. Uncle stood up and shouted, "What is annex? You mean steal? You steal from us?" Several frightened family members jostled Uncle out and tried to calm him, but the entire village reeled in dismay, and the state condemned the land and the humble houses and the sagging barns and the tack and tool sheds so that the land could be bought for pennies on the dollar. And those who worked the land, and those who loved the land, and those who lived on and through the land, were allowed no recourse, no say-so. For Uncle and the other refugee immigrants of our family and those of our many war survivor neighbors nearby, these events were terrifyingly close to the deep travails they had endured during the war. Their land was occupied against their wills. Their farms, their crops, their livelihoods, and more so, their spirits and what mattered to their spirits were seized in an instant by men in uniforms who insisted, who said they were only acting on orders, who claimed their rights over others. And Uncle Zofar went temporarily mad. The first day the bulldozers came, Uncle railed and stomped through the fields, shaking his fist at the earth movers far off in the distance. He tried to insult the drivers by yelling in Hungarian at them, but the dozer operators, not understanding Hungarian, had no idea what he was saying. He was shouting, "You know as much about God's garden as a hen knows about the alphabet!" In his misery and despair, Uncle scooped up a handful of little stones, and with all his might, he threw them at the earth-moving machines, and the pebbles hit the side of one of the machines with a sound like a handful of sand being thrown against an iron wall. Two burly workmen escorted Uncle home, each holding him by one of his arms. And Uncle was crying as they walked him to the house faster than he could keep up. "Keep this old man at home and out of our way," they snarled at us. They let go of Uncle's arms roughly and quickly, and he stumbled forward, and my elderly aunt and I caught Uncle in our arms and brought him into the house, and the big men swaggered away to their massive machines. And Uncle just refused to be comforted. He called out, "My knife has opened in my pocket, do you understand?" And it's an old family way of saying one feels a terrible despair and yet is helpless to act. And the relatives stood in an anxious little huddle, and they whispered, "Send in the child, the child, the child, send in the child." They went in to my uncle, and he tearfully took my hands, and his words were ever so many, and I tried, but I could not quite grasp the meaning of his words with my mind. But the tone of his broken words, and all the hopes and fears behind and underneath them, I felt these. I not only understood them, but I felt like I could cry for him, and for all the people of the world. I felt like I could cry until the very end of time. So everyone in the community prayed, literally prayed, in the pews of the churches, for the road commission to come to their senses, for the bureaucrats to change their plans for the good of all, for the carving of the land to be stopped, for God to send this highway away, far away, forever. But it was not meant to be. Every day the earth movers came. And every day they bleated and whined and ground, cutting down and through the prime forest and farmland. One morning we heard Uncle outside, and the sounds of hoes and rakes clashing and clattering and stacks of iron tools falling over. "I am doing something," Uncle cried. "I am doing something." He seized two enormous shovels. Our shovels and hoes were sharpened on great whetstone wheels. All tool edges were sharp as razors. This was a holdover from the old country, where one might have to use one's tools not only to dig, but also to defend oneself. And no one in the family had lived long enough away from war to have found reason to outgrow this practice. So everyone cried, "No, Zofar, no, put the shovels down. What are you doing? Do not do something rash. Zofar, Zofar!" But Uncle did not answer. He marched toward the fields with a shovel on either shoulder. "One to rest and one to work," he said. All morning he dug in a small parcel of what was left of a larger field after the toll road bed had cut through. In their passion to make the road, some workers had plowed up far more field land than needed, and the broken trunks of trees and the destroyed corn rows were all that they had left behind. They turned a living field into debris, and then they walked away. The new toll road was now complete, and its pavement lay less than 300 yards to the west, and so Uncle dug deeply along the perimeter of the field, following the general camber of the new highway and leaving behind a long, snaking mound of dirt. He dug and he shoveled and he shoveled and dug, and various neighbor men interrupted their own work to walk down the road to advise. And they returned with shovels and pickaxes to help. By afternoon, for as far as one could see, there was a trench that ran along the edge of about one half of 1 hectare. It was perhaps 2 cubits wide across the narrow side of the field that would remain in village hands. A night fell, and Uncle trudged home, and he ate a big meal of soup from a pottery bowl with a mujur bird painted on the side, and he chewed down a chunk of black homemade rye bread, and he downed a stinging cold beer from an amber glass bottle. And then he left the house again, carrying an old dented red bucket brimming with fuel. He walked, tilted way over to one side with his burden. There in the field, in the completely windless night, he carefully poured the fuel all along the field on 2 sides and once down the middle. And from the edge of the field, he struck wooden stick matches and threw them in low at several places. And the entire field erupted in a blaze so great that it drew people from as far away as the black smoke cloud in the night sky could be seen. The wide dirt roads on 3 sides and the trench on 1 side kept the blaze contained. And far into the night, men and women with sleepy children in their arms stood in long orange lines, nodding their heads approvingly and watching the field burn and burn.
Still with me. diamonds. You've got your pretty clothes. The chauffeur drives your car. You let everybody know. But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire. Your mother, she's an heiress, owns a block in St. John's Wood. And your father'd be there with her if he only could. But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire. Her diamonds and tiaras by the score. Now she gets her kicks in Stepney, not in Knightsbridge anymore. So don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire. Some diamonds, and you will have some others. You better watch your step, girl, or start living with your mother. So don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire. Don't play.
Come stand with me, my darling, among the trembling pines. We feel his presence all around, fire in the sky. Oh, oh, again. In this hushed and tranquil place, our souls become entwined. We feel his presence everywhere, all powerful, divine. Fire in the blood again.
Who in your merry, merry month of May, who by very slow decay,
and who shall I say is calling? And who in her lonely slip, who by barbiturate, who in these realms of love, by something blunt, who by avalanche, who by powder, who for his greed, who for his hunger, and who shall I say is calling? by accident? Who in solitude? Who in this mirror? Who by his latest command? Who by his own hand? Who in mortal chains? Who in power? And who shall I say is calling?
Stroke of midnight, ride the broomstick with Fallen Woman, a weekly psychic fusion and magical foray, stirring up the cauldron at Radio Free Brooklyn.